Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. Guessing we will be hearing quite a bit about the 1918 influenza pandemic now that it's the 100th anniversary of this devastating outbreak. I thought I knew a fair bit about the outbreak, but among the things I didn't know, more people died from the 1918 flu than all the military death in World War I and World War II combined, also that it may have originated in the United States. This interesting article comes from the November 2017 issue of Smithsonian Magazine. Written by John M. Barry, it is titled Journal of the Plague Year. Haskell County, Kansas lies in the southwest corner of the state, near Oklahoma and Colorado. In 1918, sod houses were still common, barely distinguishable from the treeless, dry prairie they were dug out of. It had been cattle country. A now bankrupt ranch once handled 30,000 head, but Haskell farmers also raised hogs, which is one possible clue to the origin of the crisis that would terrorize the world that year. Another clue is that the county sits on a major migratory flyway for 17 bird species, including sandhill cranes and mallards. Scientists today understand that bird influenza viruses, like human influenza viruses, can also infect hogs. And when a bird virus and a human virus infect the same pig cell, their different genes can be shuffled and exchanged like playing cards, resulting in a new, perhaps especially lethal virus. We cannot say for certain that happened in 1918 in Haskell County, but we do know that an influenza outbreak struck in January, an outbreak so severe that although influenza was not then a reportable disease, a local physician named Loring Minor, a large and imposing man, gruff, a player in local politics, who became a doctor before the acceptance of the germ theory of disease, but whose intellectual curiosity had kept him abreast of scientific developments, went to the trouble of alerting the U.S. Public Health Service. The report itself no longer exists, but it stands as the first recorded notice anywhere in the world of unusual influenza activity that year. The local newspaper, the Santa Fe Monitor, confirms that something odd was happening around that time. Mrs. Eva Van Alstine is sick with pneumonia. Ralph Lindemann is still quite sick. Homer Moody has been reported quite sick. Pete Hesser's three children have pneumonia. Mrs. J.S. Cox is very weak yet. Ralph McConnell has been quite sick this week. Merton, the young son of Ernest Elliott, is sick with pneumonia. Most everybody over the country is having la grippe or pneumonia. Several Haskell men who had been exposed to influenza went to Camp Funston in central Kansas. Days later, on March 4th, the first soldier known to have influenza reported ill. The huge Army base was training men for combat in World War I, and within 2 weeks, 1,100 soldiers were admitted to the hospital, with thousands more sick in the barracks. 38 died. Then infected soldiers likely carried influenza from Funston to other Army camps in the states. 24 of 36 large camps had outbreaks, sickening tens of thousands before carrying the disease overseas. Meanwhile, the disease spread into U.S. civilian communities. The influenza virus mutates rapidly, changing enough that the human immune system has difficulty recognizing and attacking it even from one season to the next. A pandemic occurs when an entirely new and virulent influenza virus, which the immune system has not previously seen, enters the population and spreads worldwide. Ordinary seasonal influenza viruses normally bind only to cells in the upper respiratory tract, the nose and throat, which is why they transmit easily. The 1918 pandemic virus infected cells in the upper respiratory tract, transmitting easily, but also deep in the lungs, damaging tissue, and often leading to viral as well as bacterial pneumonias. Although some researchers argue that the 1918 pandemic began elsewhere, in France in 1916 or China and Vietnam in 1917, many other studies indicate a U.S. origin. The Australian immunologist and Nobel laureate McFarlane Burnett, who spent most of his career studying influenza, concluded the evidence was strongly suggestive that the disease started in the United States and spread to France with the arrival of American troops. Camp Funston had long been considered as the site where the pandemic started until my historical research, published in 2004, pointed to an earlier outbreak in Haskell County. Wherever it began, the pandemic lasted just 15 months, but was the deadliest disease outbreak in human history, killing between 50 million and 100 million people worldwide, according to the most widely cited analysis. An exact global number is unlikely ever to be determined, given the lack of suitable records in much of the world at that time. But it's clear the pandemic killed more people in a year than AIDS has killed in 40 years, more than the bubonic plague killed in a century. The impact of the pandemic on the United States is sobering to contemplate. Some 670,000 Americans died. In 1918, medicine had barely become modern. Some scientists still believed miasma accounted for influenza's spread. With medicine's advances since then, lay people have become rather complacent about influenza. Today, we worry about Ebola or Zika or MERS or other exotic pathogens, not a disease often confused with the common cold. This is a mistake. We are arguably as vulnerable or more vulnerable to another pandemic as we were in 1918. Today, top public health experts routinely rank influenza as potentially the most dangerous emerging health threat we face. Earlier this year, upon leaving his post as head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Tom Frieden was asked what scared him the most, what kept him up at night. The biggest concern is always for an influenza pandemic. It really is the worst-case scenario. So the tragic events of 100 years ago have a surprising urgency, especially since the most crucial lessons to be learned from the disaster have yet to be absorbed. Initially, the 1918 pandemic set off few alarms, chiefly because in most places it rarely killed, despite the enormous numbers of people infected. Doctors in the British Grand Fleet, for example, admitted 10,313 sailors to sick bay in May and June, but only four died. It had hit both warring armies in France in April, but troops dismissed it as three-day fever. The only attention it got came when it swept through Spain and sickened the king. The press in Spain, which was not at war, wrote at length about the disease, unlike the censored press in warring countries, including the United States. Hence, it became known as Spanish flu. By June, influenza reached from Algeria to New Zealand. Still, a 1927 study concluded, "In many parts of the world, the first wave either was so faint as to be hardly perceptible or was altogether lacking, and was everywhere of a mild form." Some experts argued that it was too mild to be influenza. Yet there were warnings, ominous ones. Though few died in the spring, those who did were often healthy young adults, people whom influenza rarely kills. Here and there, local outbreaks were not so mild. At one French army post of 1,018 soldiers, 688 were hospitalized and 49 died, 5% of that population of young men dead. And some deaths in the first wave were overlooked because they were misdiagnosed, often as meningitis. A puzzled Chicago pathologist observed lung tissue heavy with fluid and full of hemorrhages and asked another expert if it represented a new disease. In August, the affliction resurfaced in Switzerland in a form so virulent that a U.S. Navy intelligence officer, in a report stamped secret and confidential, warned that the disease now epidemic throughout Switzerland is what is commonly known as the Black Plague, although it is designated as Spanish sickness and grip. the second wave had begun. The hospital at Camp Devens, an army training base 35 miles from Boston that teamed with 45,000 soldiers, could accommodate 1,200 patients. On September 1, it held 84. On September 7th, a soldier sent to the hospital delirious and screaming when touched was diagnosed with meningitis. The next day, a dozen more men from his company were diagnosed with meningitis. But as more men fell ill, physicians changed the diagnosis to influenza. Suddenly, an Army report noted, "The influenza occurred as an explosion." At the outbreak's peak, 1,543 soldiers reported ill with influenza in a single day. Now, with hospital facilities overwhelmed, with doctors and nurses sick, with too few cafeteria workers to feed patients and staff, the hospital ceased accepting patients, no matter how ill, leaving thousands more sick and dying in barracks. Roy Grist, a physician at the hospital, wrote a colleague, "These men start with what appears to be an ordinary attack of la grippe or influenza, and when brought to the hospital, they very rapidly develop the most vicious type of pneumonia that has ever been seen. 2 hours after admission, they have the mahogany spots over the cheekbones, and a few hours later, you can begin to see the cyanosis." The term refers to a person turning blue from lack of oxygen, extending from their ears and spreading all over the face. "It is only a matter of a few hours then until death comes. It is horrible. We have been averaging about 100 deaths per day. For several days, there were no coffins, and the bodies piled up something fierce." Devens and the Boston area was the first place in the Americas hit by the pandemic's second wave. Before it ended, influenza was everywhere, from ice-bound Alaska to steaming Africa, and this time it was lethal. The killing created its own horrors. Governments aggravated them, partly because of the war. For instance, the U.S. military took roughly half of all physicians under 45 and most of the best ones. What proved even more deadly was the government policy toward the truth. When the United States entered the war, Woodrow Wilson demanded that the spirit of ruthless brutality enter into the very fiber of national life. So he created the Committee on Public Information, which was inspired by an advisor who wrote, "Truth and falsehood are arbitrary terms. The force of an idea lies in its inspirational value. It matters very little if it is true or false." At Wilson's urging, Congress passed the Sedition Act, making it punishable with 20 years in prison to utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the form of government of the United States, or to urge, incite, or advocate any curtailment of production in this country of anything or things necessary or essential to the prosecution of the war. Government posters and advertisements urged people to report to the Justice Department anyone who spreads pessimistic stories, cries for peace, or belittles our effort to win the war. Against this background, while influenza bled into American life, public health officials, determined to keep morale up, began to lie. Early in September, a Navy ship from Boston carried influenza to Philadelphia, where the disease erupted in the Navy Yard. The city's public health director, Wilmer Crewson, declared that he would confine this disease to its present limits, and in this we are sure to be successful. No fatalities have been recorded, no concern whatever is felt. The next day, two sailors died of influenza. Crewson stated that they died of old-fashioned influenza or grippe, not Spanish flu. Another health official declared, "From now on, the disease will decrease." The next day, 14 sailors died, and the first civilian. Each day, the disease accelerated. Each day, newspapers assured readers that influenza posed no danger. Crewson assured the city he would nip the epidemic in the bud. By September 26, influenza had spread across the country, and so many military training camps were beginning to look like Devens that the Army canceled its nationwide draft call. Philadelphia had scheduled a big Liberty Loan parade for September 28. Doctors urged Krusen to cancel it, fearful that hundreds of thousands jamming the route, crushing against each other for a better view, would spread the disease. They convinced reporters to write stories about the danger. But editors refused to run them and refused to print letters from doctors. The largest parade in Philadelphia's history proceeded on schedule. The incubation period of influenza is 2 to 3 days. 2 days after the parade, Krusen conceded that the epidemic now present in the civilian population was assuming the type found in army camps. Still, he cautioned not to be panic-stricken over exaggerated reports. He needn't have worried about exaggeration. The newspapers were on his side. Scientific nursing halting epidemic, an Inquirer headline blared. In truth, nurses had no impact because none were available. Out of 3,100 urgent requests for nurses submitted to one dispatcher, only 193 were provided. Krusen finally and belatedly ordered all schools closed and banned all public gatherings. Yet a newspaper nonsensically said the order was not a public health measure and there is no cause for panic or alarm. There was plenty of cause. At its worst, the epidemic in Philadelphia would kill 759 people in 1 day. Priests drove horse-drawn carts down city streets, calling upon residents to bring out their dead. Many were buried in mass graves. More than 12,000 Philadelphians died, nearly all of them in 6 weeks. Across the country, public officials were lying. U.S. Surgeon General Rupert Blue said, "There is no cause for alarm if precautions are observed." New York City's public health director declared, "Other bronchial diseases, and not the so-called Spanish influenza, caused the illness of the majority of persons who were reported ill with influenza." The Los Angeles public health chief said, "If ordinary precautions are observed, there is no cause for alarm." For an example of the press's failure, consider Arkansas. Over a 4-day period in October, the hospital at Camp Pike admitted 8,000 soldiers. Francis Blake, a member of the Army's Special Pneumonia Unit, described the scene. "Every corridor, and there are miles of them with double rows of cots, with influenza patients, there is only death and destruction." Yet 7 miles away in Little Rock, a headline in the Gazette pretended yawns. "Spanish influenza is plain la grippe, same old fever and chills." People knew this was not the same old thing, though. They knew because the numbers were staggering. In San Antonio, 53% of the population got sick with influenza. They knew because victims could die within hours of the first symptoms. Horrific symptoms. Not just aches and cyanosis, but also a foamy blood coughed up from the lungs and bleeding from the nose, ears, and even eyes. And people knew because towns and cities ran out of coffins. People could believe nothing they were being told, so they feared everything, particularly the unknown. How long would it last? How many would it kill? Who would it kill? With the truth buried, morale collapsed. Society itself began to disintegrate. In most disasters, people come together, help each other, as we saw recently with Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. But in 1918, without leadership, without the truth, trust evaporated, and people looked after only themselves. In Philadelphia, the head of emergency aid pleaded, "All who are free from the care of the sick at home, report as early as possible on emergency work." But volunteers did not come. The Bureau of Child Hygiene begged people to take in, just temporarily, children whose parents were dying or dead. Few replied. In Luce County, Michigan, a couple and three children were all sick together, but a Red Cross worker reported, "Not one of the neighbors would come in and help. I telephoned the woman's sister. She came and tapped on the window, but refused to talk to me until she'd gotten a safe distance away." In New Haven, Connecticut, John Delano recalled, "Normally when someone was sick in those days, people would bring food over to other families, but nobody was coming in. Nobody would bring food in. Nobody came to visit." In Perry County, Kentucky, the Red Cross chapter chairman begged for help, pleaded that there were hundreds of cases of people starving to death, not from lack of food, but because the well were panic-stricken and would not go near the sick. In Goldsboro, North Carolina, Dan Tonkel recalled, "We were actually almost afraid to breathe. You were afraid even to go out. The fear was so great, people were actually afraid to leave their homes, afraid to talk to one another." In Washington, D.C., William Sardo said, "It kept people apart. You had no school life, you had no church life, you had nothing. It completely destroyed all family and community life. The terrifying aspect was when each day yawned, you didn't know whether you would be there when the sun set that day." An internal American Red Cross report concluded, "A fear and panic of the influenza, akin to the terror of the Middle Ages regarding the Black Plague, has been prevalent in many parts of the country." Then, as suddenly as it came, influenza seemed to disappear. It had burned through the available fuel in a given community. An undercurrent of unease remained, but aided by the euphoria accompanying the end of the war, traffic returned to streets, schools and businesses reopened, society returned to normal. A third wave followed in January 1919, ending in the spring. This was lethal by any standard except the second wave, and one particular case would have an exceptional impact on history. On April 3, 1919, during the Versailles Peace Conference, Woodrow Wilson collapsed. His sudden weakness and severe confusion halfway through that conference, widely commented upon, very possibly contributed to his abandoning his principles. The result was the disastrous peace treaty, which would later contribute to the start of World War II. Some historians have attributed Wilson's confusion to a minor stroke. In fact, he had a 103-degree temperature, intense coughing fits, diarrhea, and other serious symptoms. A stroke explains none of the symptoms. Influenza, which was then widespread in Paris and killed a young aide to Wilson, explains all of them, including his confusion. Experts would later agree that many patients afflicted by the pandemic influenza had cognitive or psychological symptoms. As an authoritative 1927 medical review concluded, "There is no doubt that the neuropsychiatric effects of influenza are profound, hardly second to its effect on the respiratory system." After that third wave, the 1918 virus did not go away, but it did lose its extraordinary lethality, partly because many human immune systems now recognized it, and partly because it lost the ability to easily invade the lungs. No longer a bloodthirsty murderer, it evolved into a seasonal influenza. Scientists and other experts are still asking questions about the virus and the devastation it caused, including why the second wave was so much more lethal than the first. Researchers aren't certain, and some argue that the first wave was caused by an ordinary seasonal influenza virus that was different from the pandemic virus. But the evidence seems overwhelming that the pandemic virus had both a mild and virulent form, causing mild as well as severe spring outbreaks. And then, for reasons that remain unclear, the virulent form of the virus became more common in the fall. Seasonal influenza is bad enough. Over the past four decades, it has killed 3,000 to 48,000 Americans annually, depending on the dominant virus strains in circulation, among other things, and more deadly possibilities loom. In recent years, two different bird influenza viruses have been infecting people directly. The H5N1 strain has struck in many nations, while H7N9 is still limited to China. All told, these two avian influenza viruses had killed 1,032 out of the 2,439 people infected as of this past July, a staggering mortality rate. Scientists say that both virus strains so far bind only to cells deep in the lung and do not pass from person to person. If either one acquires the ability to infect the upper respiratory tract, through mutation or by swapping genes with an existing human virus, a deadly pandemic is possible. Prompted by the reemergence of avian influenza, governments, NGOs, and major businesses around the world have poured resources into preparing for a pandemic. Because of my history of the 1918 pandemic, the Great Influenza, I was asked to participate in some of those efforts. Public health experts agree that the highest priority is to develop a universal vaccine that confers immunity against virtually all influenza viruses likely to infect humans. Without such a vaccine, if a new pandemic virus surfaces, we will have to produce a vaccine specifically for it. Doing so will take months, and the vaccine may offer only marginal protection. Another key step to improving pandemic readiness is to expand research on antiviral drugs. None is highly effective against influenza, and some strains have apparently acquired resistance to the antiviral drug Tamiflu. Then there are the less glamorous measures, known as non-pharmaceutical interventions: hand washing, telecommuting, covering coughs, staying home when sick instead of going to work, and, if the pandemic is severe enough, widespread school closings and possibly more extreme controls. The hope is that layering such actions one atop another will reduce the impact of an outbreak on public health and on resources in today's just-in-time economy. But the effectiveness of such interventions will depend on public compliance, and the public will have to trust what it is being told. That is why, in my view, the most important lesson from 1918 is to tell the truth. Though that idea is incorporated into every preparedness plan I know of, its actual implementation will depend on the character and leadership of the people in charge when a crisis erupts. And that was from the November 2017 Smithsonian Magazine. And they have a small column of, here are some of the victims who died from the 1918 influenza. John Francis Dodge and Horace Elgin Dodge, who were co-founders of Dodge Brothers Car Company. Phoebe Hearst, the mother of William Randolph Hearst. Gustav Klimt, an Austrian artist. Harold Lockwood, a silent movie star. Edmund Rostand, a playwright of Cyrano de Bergerac. Frederick Trump, grandfather of President Donald Trump. Max Weber, a German political sociologist. And here's a list of some who survived: Raymond Chandler, novelist and playwright; Walt Disney, studio executive; Lillian Gish, a silent movie star; Edvard Munch, a Norwegian artist; Georgia O'Keeffe, an American artist; John J. Pershing, U.S. general; Mary Pickford, who was a silent movie star; Franklin Roosevelt, a U.S. president; Wilhelm II, German Kaiser; and Woodrow Wilson, a U.S. president. And with that, I thank you for tuning into Sound Body. Stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas.